Hi, everyone. Last week, following our services, a young man came up to talk to me after my message. The message was about the importance of planning ahead financially. And so we just looked at Proverbs 21. It told us that those who are wise and diligent, they store up and there'll be those who prosper. And that if you're hasty and gulp down and consume everything that you bring in, that leads to poverty. And this young man came up and he said, yes, but doesn't the Bible also warn against storing things up? I mean, he said, on the one hand, the Bible seems to be saying that it's good to store things up and to save and be, you know, responsible. And on the other hand, it's bad to store things up. He said, there's this New Testament text that talks about the dangers of storing things up for yourself. And so is the Bible contradicting itself? It's a great, insightful question. And so I shared some thoughts with him in the moment, but I also asked him if he had the gift of prophecy, because that's the very passage that we're going to look at this week. And so you can find your way in your Bible or device to Luke chapter 12. That's where we're going to hang out today. And I think it will make some sense out of this apparent contradiction in the Bible. So as you get there, hopefully some of you took a step this week to start the process of planning and budgeting. And maybe planning to do something about your consumer debt. That would be great too. And if you downloaded that worksheet, you saw that one of the first empty boxes said the word giving at the top. And this is one of the keys to staying in the right zone concerning God's counsel on money. Yes, it's important to plan. Yes, it's important to store up for the future. But no, we must never put our hope and faith in riches. And one of the things that prevents money from controlling us this way is deliberately and systematically giving it away. And so our big idea says, we honor God with our faithful giving. Now, in Luke 12, Jesus finds himself responding to a heckler. A man yells out from the crowd and says, Jesus, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Man, this is the worst kind of dispute. Two siblings arguing over their inheritance. Some of you have been there. It is ugly. So this guy gets one shot at Jesus, and he chooses to ask him how he can get more money. Jesus basically says, I'm not interested in that one. You're on your own. But then he makes a very profound statement. He says this. It's in Luke 12, 15. He says, be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And so Jesus is saying to this guy, bro, you're entering the danger zone. Anytime you find yourself coveting, that just means wanting more and more for yourself, you're walking on thin ice. The problem for us in America is we don't see coveting as a sin. It's just a way of life. And it's actually one of the Ten Commandments, number 10, no coveting. Exodus 20:17 says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, covet your neighbor's wife, his servant, his male servant, his female servant, his ox. And so in today's language, God's just saying, don't covet your neighbor's tools and his truck. I mean, his donkey, that would be his car or his Jeep. Anything that's your neighbor's, including his TV, that huge one that you see when you're walking your dog and you look through the window and you see that big TV and you stop to covet. Oh, look at that TV. That's so big, I can see it from the street. I need me one of those big TVs. Jesus says, be on your guard against that. It leads down a dangerous path. And then he goes on to say, life doesn't consist in the abundance of possessions. Man, you can highlight that, circle it, underline that phrase. That's the punchline of this whole passage. Jesus is exposing this lie that we believe, and the lie is that life does consist in the abundance of possessions. We think there's going to be a prize at the end of this thing for the person with the most stuff. And frankly, that's not the way it works. And so Jesus goes on and he tells this parable. And he's going to illustrate that, and we're going to stop along the way. And eventually we're going to pull out four lessons about giving from this text. But the idea is life doesn't consist of the abundance of our possessions. Now, I like to give credit where it's due. And so some of this is inspired by a great message by Andy Stanley called In God We Trust. So let's look at verse 16 and we'll check out our first lesson. And he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And so we're introduced to our main character. He's a businessman and his business was on a hot streak. And he'd be right at home in our society. He was probably a workaholic. He was willing to do whatever it took to succeed, and it took everything. And he was on a roll. His business was on a roll. In verse 17, we learn our first lesson about giving. He hits this major crossroad, and here's the lesson. When you have extra, you have a decision. It says his crops were plentiful. He ran out of storage, and so he hits this moment of decision. Will you underline the word, what shall I do, and just write extra equals decision. When there's extra, you have a decision to make. This man had to decide about what to do with his extra, and frankly, so do we. Now, some of you were just really excited and relieved when you realized that this first point didn't apply to you, but it does. Because we as Americans in 2016, we all have extra. I mean, when we hear this story about the rich fool, what invariably happens is we think, yes, rich people, we don't like them. Good, this doesn't apply to me. I'm here to tell you, that's you, friends. You are the rich. We're the rich. This guy's goal was to get to a standard of living that we already enjoy here in America. And you see, our culture keeps us so focused on the things we don't have, the cars we don't drive, the houses we don't live in, that we're tricked into always feeling like we're lacking. But the truth is, compared to 95% of the world, we have lots of extra. I'll just give you a few examples. Do you ever eat out? If you do, you have extra money. Do you eat out? Let me phrase it differently. Do you ever pay a staff of people to prepare your food and then serve you that food? We don't often think of it that way, but if you look historically and globally, that's the treatment of kings. Do you spend money to entertain yourself? Do you drive your own vehicle? Only 3 to 5% of the people in the world own a car. Do you have a comfortable place to live? Is it dry? Is the air perfectly temperate for your comfort? Warm in the winter, cool in the summer? Do you have running water in your home? Maybe even both hot and cold water options. What about labor-saving devices with fingertip controls, a washer, a dryer, a refrigerator, a microwave? In addition to having a house for yourself, do you also have a little house for your car? We call it a garage, or our English friends would call it a garage. It's a house for your car. And if you do have a house for your car, I would venture to guess that that little house for your car is bigger than most houses around the world for a family of five. Guys, this isn't a guilt trip. This is just a reminder that we've all been blessed with extra. Let's just talk clothes for a second. We don't just have garments that protect us from the elements. We have clothes for every occasion. We have pajama clothes. We have work clothes. We have relaxed clothes. We have exercise clothes. We have workout in the yard clothes. Then we have seasonal clothes, certain colors that you wear at certain times of the year, certain sleeve lengths, certain pant legs. Most of you probably have a room in your house for your clothes that aren't in season. That room's called the attic. We have been blessed with extra. Have you ever gotten rid of something that worked just so you could get the next one that was a little bit better? We don't even wait for the old one to break or get lost anymore. We just upgrade. That's called extra. Don't get me started on garage sales and sheds and storage units. We have so much extra stuff, we don't even know what to do with all of it. Here's one that many of us have, this thing at the bottom of our sink. It's a big hole and it growls when you turn it on. You know what this is called? Yeah, a garbage disposal. Now, I don't know about you, but we've never put garbage in ours. Do you know what we always put in ours? Food. Not garbage, food. 90% of which could probably have been eaten. Again, this isn't meant to judge or to guilt anyone. I'm attempting to remind us that even the poorest person in this room, that compared to 95% of the world, we have extra. And when you have extra, you have a decision. And so have you ever asked the question, I wonder why I have so much extra? I was just in some people's homes in the Dominican Republic. We have teams in the streets of Haiti right now. And if you're there and you let your mind go, you're confronted with a question. The question is, why have I been entrusted with so much more than these people? And what am I supposed to do with it? You see, we never ask these questions. But our man in this story faces the same decision. We'll see in verse 18 that he decides to spend it on himself. Look at verse 18. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and I will build larger ones. And there I will store all of my grains and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things that you've prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. I believe that this is the lesson from these four verses, that your lifestyle doesn't always need to keep pace with your income. All right, so the man made some extra. He thought his next move was bigger barns. And so he made the same assumption that most Americans make. His assumption was, if I have extra, it's for me. If God's blessed me with extra, it's for my consumption. And we don't build bigger barns, most of us, we just get better cars and we upgrade, we trade up, we buy nicer houses. And listen, because we're so whacked out, sometimes we do these things before we even have the money to buy them. And we get neck deep into consumer debt, which is a whole different problem. But this man shows us that it's a sin to think that if I have extra, it must all be for me. And so Jesus, in his brilliant, tricky kind of way, just as the crowd is starting to get envious of this rich guy, he says, right at the height of his success, right at the height of his business's growth and his empire, the guy died. And for all of his cost-benefit analysis and his cash flow projections and the numbers he crunched, the one scenario that this man forgot to take into account was the impact of all of this on his soul and his own mortality. And as everyone else is standing at his funeral saying their words of eulogy, he was an innovator. He was an entrepreneur. He was a man of principle. He was a pillar of the community. He was a leader. He was a visionary. He was powerful. He was successful. Jesus sneaks into the funeral. He takes his place at the back seat of the pews, and he stands up quietly and he offers his one word eulogy, his one word assessment. Fool. Wow. A little harsh, isn't it? In verse 20, it says, but God said to him, you fool. Why was he a fool? Not for being wealthy. The guy couldn't help it. His crops came in super abundant way. It wasn't his fault he had extra. You fool, you fool. God, why am I a fool? Because you thought all the extra was for you. Verse 21 gives the answer and also provides an answer to our apparent contradiction with last week's message. He says, the problem is you laid up all these treasures for yourself, but you weren't rich toward God. Underline in verse 21 there, that little phrase, rich toward God, and just write, share your extra. He's not saying don't be responsible financially. He's saying in the process, you also need to be laying up treasures for yourself in heaven. That is, investing in kingdom stuff, sharing your extra. What if the health of your soul is dependent on your ability to understand that life is more than the abundance of your possessions? And in order to get that truth through our heads and into our hearts, we need to be more intentional about generosity and giving more stuff away. So should we have a plan? Should we have a budget and a savings and a retirement account? Yes, of course. But a priority item in that plan needs to be a giving plan. To keep our heart right, to assure that we're going to get to the end of our life and avoid being called a fool by God. Again, it's about our focus, it's about our hearts, it's about where we're putting our hopes and dreams and trust. And so I ask you, is your faith in your ability to earn and acquire, or in God's ability to take care of his children? Now, this story is often used to talk about retirement, so let me talk about retirement just for a minute. Does this text mean that everyone who retires is a fool? No, I don't think so. But you need to consider what's the driving motivation for retirement. You see, it's not a sin if you make enough money that someday you don't have to get up and go to that same job every day. But that doesn't mean that your whole goal is just to eat and drink and play shuffleboard and wear flip-flops and live somewhere where the sun shines and hang out with a bunch of other people who slather themselves up with therapeutic cream and talk about their most recent surgeries while sipping drinks with umbrellas in them. Right? And you just check out of life. That's not the goal of life. That's the American dream. But God has a word for that. Foolish. Because even if you retire from work, you don't retire from Christ. And so the driving goal of our lives is not a comfortable retirement. It's doing God's work. In the words of Craig Rochelle, if you're not dead, you're not done. So don't act like you're done. The point here is your lifestyle doesn't need to keep pace with your income. And so figure out what you need to live on, what you need to be responsible for your future, and then start giving some of the rest away. The goal is to be rich toward God. And so he wraps up this section in 32 through 34, and Jesus just starts to get practical. How do we avoid falling into materialism and selfishness like the rich fool in this story? Look at verse 32. It says, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. So here's how I would sum up the third lesson from this piece of the text. Raise your awareness of kingdom needs, not just earthly ones. Will you underline, if you dare, sell your possessions and give to the needy, there in verse 33. And just right next to it, give to kingdom needs. Now, we get freaked out when we read verses like this, and we probably should. I don't want to lessen the blow or try to explain this away. We should all go out and do some form of this text immediately, each in our own way. And notice that the reason that we can be so liberal in our generosity is because it's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Like if you had a dad who has really deep pockets, he's the one providing for you and bankrolling you. Remember, we're just managers. He is the owner. And so it allows us to be generous with our dad's money, okay? But I want us to dig down to an important principle that comes to light in this verse. I think one remedy for materialism is a proper awareness of the needs around us. You see, we can all get caught up in our own little bubbles of our own wants and needs. And if we're not careful, our eyes get so fixed on ourselves that we lose focus on all the needs around us. And so to get involved in Serve Erie, to sponsor a child in Haiti or the DR, to serve in the kids' ministry here at Grace or celebrate recovery, to volunteer at the mobile homeless shelter, suddenly you become personally aware of needs. You're exposing yourself to real situations. You see them with your own eyes. And something powerful happens when Christians come face to face with needs. Listen, I'm as materialistic as the next guy. Can I just confess that to you? I like stuff, especially electronics. I love gadgets. One of my recent fixations is the Apple Watch, right? Ever since it came out a couple years ago, I've been trying to figure out why I need one of those. Now, don't feel weird if you have one on right now. Wives, don't start elbowing your husbands. I am certain there are many good and justifiable reasons to own one. I'm still searching for a good reason for me. I've discovered that what drives my quest and lust for stuff is awareness. Do you know that I've never wanted one single thing that I didn't know existed? It's true. But there have been many things that as soon as I found out they existed, suddenly I wanted one. And then my brain went to work convincing myself that I didn't just want it. I needed it. And so that's one side. But here's the other side of that same coin. As I become more systematically aware of the needs in the world, needs in our community, needs in our church, it has helped me in reining in my quest for more gadgets and funnel some of that energy toward kingdom needs. That's the power of awareness. You don't become less materialistic by trying hard to become less materialistic. You become less materialistic as you refocus on your awareness of the needs of the world around you. And so if we will just raise our strategic awareness of needs in the world, in this community, in this church, we can be better at directing our treasures to kingdom ventures, which this verse tells us, do not fail. All right, finally, Jesus concludes this section with the famous words, verse 34, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. This leads to our fourth and final lesson, that is, make your money lead your heart into generosity. You should just probably underline that whole verse, 34. It's an important one. And just write somewhere next to it, money leads the heart. Now that feels a little funny, doesn't it? Almost backwards, because we're always emphasizing the heart here. The heart is the center of the being. It's the command control of our lives. If Jesus changes our heart, we say, he can change our whole lives. That is true. And so we would expect this verse to say, wherever your heart is, your money will follow. But he actually says exactly the opposite. He says your heart will follow the money trail. And so if you put some money into fantasy football, guess where your heart's going to be? Fantasy football. If you put some money into the stock market, guess what you're going to be checking all the time? If you spend money on collections or clothes or furniture or hobbies, your heart will follow. We care about our money, and so we care about the things that our money funds. And so Jesus' point is, that if you want to get your heart to the right place, put your money in the right place. Make your money lead your heart into generosity. It's why God's idea of percentage giving is so brilliant. Because when I decide to be a percentage giver and give the first percentage of my income to God and to His church, you know what that does? It leads my heart toward the right stuff. It forces me to adjust my kingdom and my lifestyle accordingly. It keeps me from ever giving him leftovers. It keeps me from ever getting to the end of the month and saying, well, let me see how much I have so I can decide how much I'll give. It ensures that I don't allow everything that comes my way to be consumed by me. Percentage giving allows me to be intentionally generous and doesn't leave it to the hands of my feelings or emotions, which can, quite honestly, be unpredictable and trustworthy. So generosity starts with a decision, just like every other important thing. Am I upfront choosing my priorities? This is one of the reasons that I believe so strongly in electronic giving. We have a fantastic system here at Grace where you can automate your giving. And what are you doing? You're deciding upfront to be generous. If you want to see results, you put a system in place. It's just true. Take two guys and a dentist. Sounds like the start of a bad joke. But one of the guys, every time he goes to the dentist, at the end of his little appointment, he schedules his next trip. The other guy leaves and he waits until he's in the mood to see the dentist, which never comes. Which guy is going to enter his retirement years with all his teeth? The guy who builds it into his schedule. You see, if you want results, you put a system in place. The same goes with your giving. Put a system in place. And the question that always comes when I talk about percentage giving is, how much are you talking about? And where should I give it? Well, in the Old Testament, God set up a practice, and he put it into place that would systematically remind people that all they have is his, and that a portion of that should go back to him right at the very beginning. And so in the Old Testament, God gave Israel the practice of tithing, giving 10% of one's income to God. If you add it all up now in the Old Testament, all the tithes that were required, it was actually north of 30%. But the word tithe, it actually means a tenth. In the New Testament, though, the tithe isn't directly commanded. Jesus talks about it, but it's not directly commanded. However, Jesus came, and as usual, he did what he always does. He raised the bar. And so the New Testament teaching is not that 10% of your stuff is God's, but 100% of your stuff is God's. He reminds us that it's on loan to you, but it's all his. And so here at Grace, we encourage the tithe as a starting place. It's like kind of a training wheels toward true generosity. And there are some of you who aren't doing this and who are just a decision away from going on an adventure with God. I mean, I know tons of stories of people who just went cold turkey into giving 10% of their income away, and it was no turning back. It is a soul-expanding, heart-pounding adventure of generosity that we're all supposed to be on. And there are some of you that, for a variety of reasons, can't start with 10%. But I want to challenge you to do something. I want to challenge you to choose a percentage. Decide to prioritize it and do it. And if you're in a rut or a crisis today, you're loaded up with debt or whatever, you get some help. We have a great course starting tomorrow night, January 23rd, at all of our locations called Financial Peace University. We're also offering the follow-up class called Legacy Journey. These things should be required courses for everyone. But do something to get into the generosity game. And frankly, there are some of you who 10% isn't even scratching the surface. You should be asking, is giving at my current percentage helping me in my generosity? And if not, it's time to ratchet it up. Take your heart for a little joyride. So the other question then is, where should I give? There are many wonderful organizations and causes to give to. And call me old school, but I just can't get away from the idea in the Bible that the Christian should funnel the majority of their giving to their primary community of faith, their church. I mean, I would expect believers who call Grace their church home and attend here and are spiritually fed here and involved in the mission here to not have the majority of their giving going to other organizations. After all, the local church is the hope of the world. It's how God has arranged for the redemption of the planet until he comes back. And we can do more together. This is always a tightrope walk, I understand. You know, I received some criticism this year after Christmas at the Warner. Some folks said, you know, I walked by and saw that expensive soundboard that you guys use, and I thought, how many poor people could have been fed with that? It's a legitimate concern. And we feel the tension all the time between creating infrastructure that will allow the church to continue to grow and reach more people and how much to give to felt needs in the community and around the world. And I just want to tell you, a big chunk of our annual budget goes to outreach projects and people, by the way. But the truth is, as we expand the base of Christians by growing the church and the number of people that we're reaching and discipling, it actually allows us to do more for the poor and the marginalized in the community than if we just gave every dollar away as it came in. The truth is, we can do more together. And guys, we have some massive plans for downtown Erie that we're going to be announcing soon. And it's going to take an army of people and some serious funding to pull it off. And when it comes right down to it, Jesus didn't say, I'll build an orphanage. He didn't say, I'll build a soup kitchen. He said, I'll build my church, and the gates of hell won't prevail against it. And so, yes, I believe that our energies and our efforts and even our funding should be directed through the church for the good of the communities that we exist in. Now, let me challenge you with one more thing about generosity. Don't wait. Don't wait to be generous. So many people think, I'll be generous once I have more. Guys, it's just been proven again and again that this rarely happens. As income levels go up, actually the percentages of charitable giving go down. So start now, because the point here is that your money leads your heart. And as more of your money is invested in kingdom stuff, then the more of your heart that is softened and surrendered to the King. A staggering statistic, the average American in their lifetime will earn about $2 million. For most of you in this room, being who we are, it's going to be far more than that. So passing through our hands in the ensuing years will be millions of dollars. And every day we're going to vote $1 at a time as to whether or not we will be faithful toward God with our money. There's a battle for your heart going on. So vote for His kingdom over yours again and again. Let your money lead your heart. So I want to challenge you at the end here. Will you take a step forward today in your giving? I've given a bunch of practical ideas throughout this message today. Will you take one of those classes? Or if you're not giving at all, will you start giving something? Or if you're giving haphazardly, will you start giving systematically? Or if you're tipping God a small percentage, will you move toward the tithe? Or if you keep forgetting to give, will you set up an electronic account? God is honored, as our big idea says, by our faithful giving. And it's good for your heart too. Let me just close us today with this thought. You know, generosity has at its source, at its foundation, the grace of God. One of the ways that you will know that you've truly experienced the grace of God is that you'll start becoming more and more generous. If you need to be commanded to give again and again, it's an indicator that you've never really experienced or grasped His grace. Because if you've truly experienced the grace of God, your mindset about your possessions, it radically changes. When you know what Jesus has done for you, everything else becomes expendable. You know that you really love someone when you're willing to give them everything. Married people, do you remember your wedding ceremony? You essentially stood in front of a minister and all your friends, and you looked this other person in the eyes, and you said, "Everything I have is yours." I mean, it's pretty radical what love will do to our wallets. I've watched my boys wrestle with this truth as they've had girlfriends. I mean, there comes this date or this dance or this homecoming or whatever it is, and they look at me and go, "Dang, this is expensive." And there's like this secret cost-benefit analysis going on in their heads. Do I love her $20 worth? Do I love her $100 worth? And when you hit marriage, it's like, I love her everything I have worth. Love does funny things to our wallets. And when we're talking about God's love, God said to us, "I'm giving you everything I have." Remember the famous words in John 3:16. God so loved the world that He what? That He gave. He gave what? His Son. And so when we experience love and grace at that level, the true believer says, "God, I owe you everything in return." By contrast, someone who's just playing the religious game says, "God, you owe me. I've worked hard for you. Look how much I'm doing for you. You need to give me this and you need to give me that." This person hasn't experienced true grace. Some of you are here today and you don't know where you stand with Jesus. And you came maybe to grace for the first time today, and you came during the money talk, and I get that. But there's great truth here, even for you. And I believe that Jesus wants you here. And if radical generosity doesn't make sense to you right now, I understand that. And it just means that you haven't fully grasped the grace of God yet. I understand that too. It's okay. But I'd say, don't worry about your money today for the time being. It's your relationship with God that needs straightened out. Focus on that right now. The money stuff will come later. Fair enough? All right. You know, I'm really excited about next week. next week I'm going to be preaching on something I've never covered before in all my years of being a pastor, and that's spending. Now, you'll probably expect one thing, and I think it's going to completely surprise you the angle that we come at that. So be sure to come back for next week as we figure out how to honor God with our spending. God bless you guys.